Confessions of a Conspiracy Theorist. Share with you now tales from my journey as we look into what it is that makes a conspiracy theorist. Am I an anomaly just waiting to pass? Or is there something to this? Something that I have grasped? So how did I come to have such a different view of reality? It started in my youth, for sure. I began with studies of the pyramids and the enigmas of the world, and I found it wonderful and amazing as I looked into books that showed me 12-inch men mummified inside of a rock. I wanted to gather more of this knowledge. I was a fairly intelligent child, and being such, they actually stuck me into special programs in elementary school and filled my head full of trivia, full of interesting information. I went through cards after cards of information and then would regurgitate the trivia that I had learned. I'm certain that that's where I learned that Friday the 13th marked the date of the fall of the Templars, back when I was in elementary school in some special ed program. I explored the world from a book, and I couldn't get enough as a child. I really wanted to know more and more about the strange things that people couldn't seem to explain. How did the pyramids get there? Things of this nature. And me and my friends, we were constantly speaking of UFOs, and I don't know why this is. And really, I remember us telling tales to one another of craft that we had seen, but I have no recollection today of seeing any craft back in my youth. Of course, there does seem to be some missing bits and pieces back there. And so I grew up, and I got bored with school like everyone else, and so I was a smart aleck, and I was in a punk rock band in high school, and we actually weren't allowed to play in the high school talent show because we were too raw, I guess. The name of our band was Morning Sickness, but we spelled that MourInng. And we were actually very popular in the punk world, getting really big. But the high school principal didn't see it that way, and he decided that we shouldn't be able to play. But instead, he inserted a group that was going to lip sync some punk rock music, and strangely enough, dress in very similar to almost exact clothing. Now, these were the jocks dressed up as punk rockers, lip syncing punk rock, and well, they found us offensive and wouldn't let us play, but then these jocks dressed as us brought out a toilet on the stage, and at the end of their lip sync, they let out a large flushing. This was okay, but the music that we created was not. Now, I'll tell you, we got written up in Maximum Rock and Roll. It was my picture there on the cover. It was always so funny because they called me Iron Man, because I was a heavy metaler in the band, and typically the punks and the heavy metalers didn't hang together, and but that's what made Morning Sickness so wonderful. And we actually we're going to open for UK Subs and TSOL, but the band fell apart. Sometimes I guess the stress of making it's just a little too much. So, this was some of the concepts that were beginning to come to me of authority figures. And certainly my principal got cut down to about the size of a toad in the high school newspaper. He did a good job of thwarting the local paper from interviewing me, because well, we did protest the whole event of the talent show, and the news did want to talk to me, but he stopped them. But the high school paper wrote an article that cut him down to size. And so he suspended me for coming to school one day right before graduation, and I didn't get to graduate with my class. I had to go to summer school in my senior year. Yeah, so I was learning about authority figures. Of course, the school felt like a prison, and I grew up in one of the richer communities in America, in Florida. And high school cheerleaders that would go through two or three Porsches in a couple of years. I certainly wasn't in that category. I actually left high school and became a beach bum. I started to learn the divine synchronicities at this point. It was quite amazing. We just always seemed to be at the right place at the right time. And we found some incredible events. Imagine if you were to be a beach bum on Daytona Beach for 3 months of spring break as the college students transfer out every 2 weeks. You get a new crew. Oh my God. I mean, we're talking a long party. And we actually considered ourselves to be professional partiers, because we didn't understand where all of our food and gas and beer and everything came from. We didn't know where it was coming from. We just were always loaded with stuff and ready to go. In the van, it went where it needed to go. Well, we actually started in a Camaro, three guys living in a Camaro with a surfboard. I kid you not. You would fight to sleep in the front seat because they got those bucket seats in the back and the surfboard over your face. But in this path of just true liberty, I learned what the life really has to offer. And when I was asked to stop that and return to society, I didn't want to, but so I did. And yeah, at one point I had actually even gone into the recruiter's office and tried to get into the military. I wanted to be Air Force if I was going to be anything, because I heard, well, it was a little easier and it was more brainy and less of the, it just seemed cool, right? And they wouldn't take me. My driving record was too bad, and the only people that would take me were the Army. And I was like, well, hell no. And I walked out of there, and I thought for a second. I looked at my friend that was with me, the one that had been living in the Camaro with me, and we were like, oh my God, what did we just do? What have we done? I mean, oh no, we can't do that. Oh my God, we almost signed our lives away. Whew, slipped the noose. So then I headed out and thought, well, I'd go to what I now lovingly call robot school, these technical institutes. I'd always had a knack for drafting and architecture, and so I wanted to go that route and, trying to select my career, right? And, I didn't last a day. I couldn't take it. It was so monotonous and ridiculous, and I just can't imagine all these people being programmed to be machines. And that's why I call it robot school. So that didn't last long before I was like, oh man, I gotta look a little deeper. And I ended up at community college, and they were offering a course that was honors. And it was a 2.5-year course called Interdisciplinary Studies, in which we learned the thought of man from ancient cavemen on up to quantum physics. And it was quite an amazing class. I wish that it was offered in every school, and I wish I could take the time to really describe it to you, but suffice it to say that I learned a lot. I mean, we covered cathedrals and Nietzsche, all over the place. We started with Jonathan Livingston Seagull and ended with the Tao of Physics, you know what I mean? Very interesting. Probably, produced by the Club of Rome. I think that's where I also read Limits to Growth for the first time. But it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it, and I love to learn, so I raced right through that, and I learned how to write and it was amazing. 2.5 years. So that covered all my required classes, too. The only thing I had to take other than that was my math. And I loved math. I would tutor math for fun. I learned a lot there. And this opened my eyes to a great many other things. And in that class, I ended up meeting a friend who I can only describe as a cross between Aleister Crowley and Jim Morrison. This guy, me and him, boy, whew, had some crazy, crazy times. He was the one that introduced me to Freemasonry for the first time. He showed me the compass and square symbol and started talking about that. Now, we all considered him a genius. You couldn't ask him a question he didn't have an answer for. He introduced me to the concepts of magic and some of the thoughts and understandings that I now have. It was interesting because before I get to us graduating college, there was another friend there with us, and we were the three amigos, as it were, and the other friend and I were the ones that, well, I don't know if you guys know my UFO story, so I'll tell you a little bit. me and this friend went down to Daytona Beach, and it was spring break, of course, and it was about 10 p.m., and we were going to go hit the club. But we decided that first we'd just check out the beach. You know, you drive all that way. It's about an hour and 40 minutes or so from Orlando, depending on how fast you go. And so we decided, walk down to the beach first before we join the massing throng of people and all the cars and madness down the strip. And so we cruised down to the beach, and we sat up on a lifeguard stand just watching the waves. And now, the strange thing about this is I really don't remember it arriving, and I honestly don't remember it leaving. I just remember us sitting there pointing at this large, huge, I mean, this thing was massive, rectangle floating over the ocean. It was solid in its rectangular form, subdivided into four squares. And in those four squares was like translucent red light. And we sat, and I've never heard of such a craft ever being described. So I'm still looking for anyone else that had seen such a thing, or if they know of reports of that nature. I've never heard of this giant rectangle. So we're just sitting there pointing at it with our jaws dropped. And then I remember our finger following it as it left. I remember watching the finger go by, but not the craft as it left. And so we were all excited. We couldn't believe this. I mean, you know, even after you've experienced something like this, you still don't believe it. Even to this day, I have my doubts, even though I know I saw it. You know what I mean? Your brain just has a curious time with such events. But and to have somebody to share it with, you know, knowing that there's somebody else there that saw, and we were both so excited, we jumped down, and we had to go tell somebody what we had just seen. And we now the beach is just one block over, and there's no buildings in between it and the strip, and we walk over to the strip, and there are no people. There's no cars, there's no people, and we wonder, I mean, there had been thousands, you know, it's spring break. And so we walked down and got down the street a little ways, and then we did eventually run into a group of guys coming our way. And so we asked them what time it was, and it was now 3 in the morning. Somehow we had lost all that time. To us, it was a matter of 10 minutes. We had such thoughts as we were walking down that street, wondering, well, could everybody have been abducted, and you know, we're the only ones left on planet Earth? Now, as curious as my life is, I had forgotten the rest of this tale, but I ended up eventually moving to Lawrence, Kansas, and I see my friend walking down the street. And I'm thinking, oh my God, you know, my life is just so miraculous. It just cracks me up. And, you know, how many times do I have to say, what a small planet? So here he comes walking up the street. Now I'm just like, oh my God. And it turns out his girlfriend is going to Kansas University, and he's there visiting. So I bring him over to my house, and I introduce him to all my friends. And of course, I've told all my friends this story, and some of them have heard it many times. He starts to just tell the story without me leading him into it or anything. You know, he's like, you remember? And so it confirmed it in front of everyone, and I was so happy that he did that. And then he reminded me as the end of the story that when we had gotten back to my street, we couldn't recognize what street was which. Like, we made our way back there but didn't know which road to turn on. And my road's just one off the highway. And I had forgotten even that until he popped back up into my life and reminded me. What a curious, curious world.
Thank you.
my friend, who I'll call Alistair Morrison, had introduced me to Freemasonry and some of the concepts behind the Illuminati. And in this, I started to decipher some of the clues in my own life and realized that, well, for one, my father was a Freemason, and that was quite curious, because I used to use his Masonic cufflinks as a space insignia on my collar when I played Battlestar Galactica as a kid. How curious that is, being that I now believe that the Masons are an extraterrestrial cult, and that's exactly what Mormonism promotes. And, once again, what a strange planet. Well, I come to find out that my father wasn't just a worshipful master of the Freemasons of the Kaiserslautern Lodge in Germany, but also was on Killer One submarine with Jimmy Carter. And they wrote to each other when Jimmy became president. And then I find that he also was chasing flying saucers for Project Blue Book. And, you know, of course, the only thing he ever told me was, yeah, flying saucers are real. So I had to live with that, you know. It's my dad. So then I go on to find out that my mother is also a member. She's a member of the Eastern Star, or was, and she had been married to the Grand Potentate of Freemasonry in Germany, and he is the one that raised my father to a Master Mason. And my mother is Esther in the Eastern Star, and I start to learn stories about her life and youth and, you know, growing up in France during World War II. And so I started to understand a little more about what it was like to have warfare thrown into your face. Because here in America, we don't know anything about that. We've never had a great war here. So I learned how quickly and easily a war could just find you. So really, you know, the difference between a conspiracy theorist and, a not-conspiracy theorist is that we believe that there is a hidden hand that is causing these events. But it all starts with a question, a seeking. You know, we've run into all these wonderful, good humans, and then we wonder, well, why is civilization so bad? And the answers come in a miraculous fashion. So me and Mr. Alistair Morrison decided to hit the road, and I started making juggling sticks and found that I could travel wherever I wanted to with them, and a little black and white spotted dog with polka dotted feet decided to jump in the van with us, and we headed off to Washington, D.C. Yeah, if you had a van and you could go anywhere and it didn't matter and you had no thoughts on where you were going to go, then why not the nation's capital, right? Well, when we arrive there, we find that there is a massive group of hippies encamped in front of the White House. And this is Bill Clinton's White House at the time. And, I had first run into the rainbow right before that. And that's who was sitting out in front of the White House. And so there were a couple of familiar faces, and I started to mingle in with these people. And of course, when I first met the rainbow, I said to myself, well, here you all are. Here I thought I was the only human on planet Earth, but turns out there's a number more. They're just in hiding. And we sat out in front of Bill Clinton's house protesting their want to create permits to stay in the national forest. And I was against this, and so I decided to stay there. And we had a big school bus, and we were feeding homeless people out of it, and I joined in with that crew, and everybody was helping out. And it's funny, too, because, you know, you'd wheel this big hot pot of soup out to the homeless people, and it was cold, you know, it was kind of cold at that time, and they were, oh, ain't you got no sandwiches? No, just good hot soup for you. You know, can't please everybody, right? So, as we're sitting out there, some really, really weird events occurred, and We believe it was our power, you know, this natural power of the human. Because as we were sitting out there one day, a strange wind blew in, and it brought all of these newspapers from around this statue. And these newspapers were just running end over end and spreading themselves out across the park. And it was just very bizarre looking. It looked like a mob of paper running end over end coming to attack. And they ran past us, and all the hippies were running after the paper, trying to grab hold of it and clean it up, you know. And as they did, the paper would actually run away from them, and it was really interesting to watch. And all of a sudden, all the paper just stopped and lined up on the other side of the park in just a nice row. And we thinking, oh my God, you know, this paper's getting ready for the attack. And sure enough, now the wind comes from a completely opposite direction all of a sudden, and that paper just comes back at us all. And I swear to you, every one of us got hit by a piece on its way out. And then it just went back behind the statue and vanished. Not a sheet of paper left there. And we are thinking, oh my God, how strange. So we decided to walk up the hill to the McDonald's and see if they'd give us some free food. They didn't. But on our way back down the hill, we see this gross brown sludge coming uphill at us. You know, imagine this brown water traveling uphill towards you. And my friends, being a little quicker than me, I guess, jumped across the street before the water came up. And I wanted to see what it was, so I stayed on that side of the sidewalk and ended up getting trapped down as I got to the bottom of the hill. Because it turned out that a sewer main had blown up while we were up the hill, and it had such a pressure that it actually pushed this stuff uphill. And the entire White House was surrounded in sewage for 3 days. Oh, I couldn't believe it. We were all just like, ah, yeah, Mother Nature loves us. I happened to be hanging out with a shaman at the time and a Rastafari. And, you know, so of course we knew it was our very energy that had caused Mr. Clinton's house to be surrounded in, poop. Well, that shaman, I actually ended up spending 9 days sleeping in front of the White House there. I was protesting the protesters who weren't willing to stay and sleep in the park and really make themselves seen. A lot of them were going to a house up the street and sleeping there. So I stayed for 9 days solid in that park in front of the White House. Many, many pictures. Oh my God, it was like, well, I know what it's like to have a paparazzi around, let's just say. Oh, very interesting things that occurred there. Me and my friends were in a court in one of the squares of the park, and we decided, well, we knew that we were being surveilled, of course, so we thought we'd see what happens if we whistle really loud. And I can't really whistle, so I had an ocarina, and I just used the highest pitched note it could do, and then my friends also whistled along, and we just let it rip. And the next thing we know, all the sprinklers in that square of the park come on, and I see all the hippies out there grabbing their blankets and everything and running, and we're looking at ourselves thinking, did we do that? So just to, you know, being scientific, we decided we'd go over to the next square and do it again. And so we did. Sure enough, all the sprinklers went off in the that square and came on in the square we were in, and we just laughed. Couldn't believe it. Yeah, that's the, you know, we must have blown somebody's eardrums, I'm sure we did. But so I was hanging with that shaman a bit and learning a little bit about American shamanism, and pretty much knew I was already an American shaman. And so as we parted, he had lost his shaman stones, which was a pendulum made out of pipestone and quartz crystal, which hang off of a leather string. And we searched and searched and searched the van for it and could never find it. So he says to me, well, those stones are yours, if they turn up. And we parted ways, and me and my friend, Alistair Morrison, headed off to follow the purple school bus up to Pennsylvania. And As soon as we got in the van and started driving away, I opened up the little container next to my seat, and there were those stones just sitting there. Now, we had checked that container numerous times, dug around, dug in it, and everything, and when I opened it this time, those stones were just sitting right on top. Very curious. So we went along and we fed some homeless people there in Pennsylvania and Philadelphia, and we were just all sitting in a neighborhood, and there was an empty house spot, an empty lot right there. And during the day, I happened to just go take a nap, and well, the next thing I knew, I was walking on the other side of the building, and I had my two cups in my hand, and they're large cups, because as a hippie with rainbow, you know, the bigger the cup, the better, because that's what you eat out of. And I'm walking along, and all of a sudden, this gust of wind comes up behind me, and it catches these two cups, and they lift me up into the air. And I start to fly around the school bus, and I'm looking around, and I look down at everybody and all of their work that they're doing and their labors of love, and then I see myself over there sleeping in the empty lot with all the other kids. And so I fly around a little bit and look, and I go over and land by my body, and I get up. And when I get up and I look around, everything is exactly as I had seen it. So my memory, which I guess now was a dream, was a memory of flying. I had no break in between. It really seemed real. So that was my, well, I think my second or third out-of-body experience, but definitely the most vivid and dramatic one. So me and Alistair Morrison rolled on from there and just started wherever we wanted to go. And honestly, I never had a direction, so I was traveling about 100 miles when he asked me, well, where are we going? I was like, oh, I don't know, pick a spot. You're navigator, you're sitting in that seat, pick a spot. So he did. We mostly stuck to college towns because they seem to be the most lively and have the most awake people in them, and just occurrence after occurrence led us from one situation to the next, and once again we were following that same path that I had followed as a beach bum, where we just always happened to be at the right place at the right time. Well, much to my dismay, my friend had brought his entire magical library with him. He kept saying, well, what can I do? I can't just leave it at this house. He was living with a family that had been taking care of him, and he didn't feel he could safely leave his books there. Well, it turned out that those books were too heavy for the van, and it blew the main seal of the engine, and there the van sat. Not sure what state we were in then, but this was the state that he was going to meet his family at to get back to his dad. And so he wasn't too concerned, although he had to walk away from his books, and I expected that we would go back and get the van and fix it. And but we started to walk, and he was upset, and I told him, no, don't worry, man, just sit down, I'll roll a cigarette, and somebody will come by and pick us up. We were trying to get to our first Grateful Dead concert, and I'd never really done a Grateful Dead concert. I ran into the Dead. Actually, I skipped that story. We ran into the Dead in Atlanta before we got to D.C., but that was quite an experience. It was kind of surreal, with helicopters over our heads and all the little hippies in their school buses down the street. And as I arrived at the Atlanta Civic Center, in the middle of downtown, there were all these hippies with a huge bonfire in the middle of the city, dancing naked, burning money with a huge drum circle in this bank court. Well, it turned out that Rainbow had met up with the Deadheads that time, and so it was actually the Rainbow I was seeing, and the Deadhead were the others that were in their vans and whatnot. And honestly, I never really liked the Deadheads right off. They were too aggressive for me and way too capitalistic. I was more with the Rainbow feel, where everything was free and beautiful. So now we were at a Dead show somewhere else, and the van had blown up, and we started to walk, and I tell him, well, just sit down, it'll all be fine. Let me roll this cigarette, 'cause I already knew from this point that, that there was a force carrying us forward. And he got all mad and was like, "No, we got a long walk to go." And he took off and he started walking. And so I sat there and I rolled my cigarette and I got it lit. And the moment I got it lit, a car pulled up. "Hey, you need a ride?" I'm like, "Absolutely." And so I jumped in the car and we rolled up on poor Alistair Morrison as he's walking away and picked him up too. And I didn't want to rub it in his face too much, but I was just like, "I told you." So we rolled up to the show. And I was a square peg in a round hole there. I couldn't get anything I needed. No one there seemed to want to care for anybody, and I really was mad at the Deadheads. I finally had to turn to the Hare Krishnas to get my dinner, and they really they made me mad. They really did, because they were just way too capitalistic, and I thought if we were going to save this planet, we had to break away from that paradigm. And eventually, I couldn't make any money or anything, and the concert was over, and everybody started to leave, and I was like, "Oh my God, what am I gonna do?" And I'm standing in the dark in this lot as it empties out, and there were barely a few vehicles left, and my friend had already left to go to his father's, so I was just all alone for the very first time in the middle of the country, not even really knowing where I was or where I was gonna go. And all of a sudden, one of the last vehicles, I spotted a girl that I had met. She was also making and selling juggling sticks, and we had kind of bonded on that level. So I stopped her and kind of panicked and was like, "Hey, I really need to get out of here. Do you mind if I ride along with you?" And she says to me, "Well, I'm going to Canada." I said, "Well, all right." And so I jumped in her van. Well, it turns out that her father was president of the Elevators Union in Canada and was now vice president of the Elevators Union in America. And so she took me home first. And I had pretty much left all my clothes and everything in my van, so all I had was what I was wearing. And I took a shower at her parents' house and then put my old clothes back on. They happened to notice. But that was the kind of hippie I was at that point. I was free and easy, and I didn't need any of these strange paradigm thoughts. Everything was fine in my world. But I think she brought me home just to upset her parents anyway, because you know how these rich girls are. But we had a little car phone before. This was before cell phones were even around, and amazing how fast things change. So she puts me in her van and we start rolling towards Canada, and it was a long trip, and along the way she started to get a little tired of me because I didn't play into her poor me philosophy. She really wanted to complain and about everybody and everything, and that's just not my way, and so I wasn't feeding her the energy that she wanted. And by the time we got to the Canada border, she was really ready for me to go. And of course, I still had my little dog with me, a little black and white spotted dog, Yin Yang. And we pull up to the border at Canada, and she says, "Well, what was I thinking? You can't cross the border. I mean, you got your dog with you. You don't have any money. They're not going to ever let you into Canada." And I said to her, "Well, don't worry. I'll make myself invisible." And she says, Oh, all right." Now, I'll tell you, I have been practicing invisibility for some time, and I've used it many, many occurrences with my little dog, too, to the point of walking into a McDonald's and ordering us both a burger and sitting at the table together, and him just eating his little burger at the table and nobody seeing us, except for children. The children always will see you, and I would just smile at them and give them a little sign of Hippocrates or putting my finger up to my lips, and they would always get it. They never gave me away. And I used to take buses from Denver to Boulder every day and back, which was a $5 bus, and you're not allowed to have your dog there either, and they wouldn't see me. I'd just walk on, sit down, and walk off. It was all a matter of what energy you projected. And so as we pulled up to the border, I was sitting in between the two seats in the van. I wasn't hiding. I had my foot up on the passenger seat, and I had my dog in my arms, and I was speaking to this girl. But I was thinking invisible thoughts, and really the invisible thoughts require you to feel at place, that you belong exactly where you are, and never doubting that. I've actually walked right past security guards at concerts in the same way, just knowing that I belong there. So we pull up, the guard asks her for her ID, and she gives it to him and says, "All right," and tells us to roll along. She looks over at me and she says, "Well, that has never happened before." I said, "I told you." So we rolled on into Canada. And we took a ferry, and she took me over to the most beautiful prison island I'd ever been on. And I call it a prison island because, well, I had no money and I was trapped there once she brought me there. I couldn't sell a thing. It was the weirdest thing. I was trapped in this realm of not being able to provide for myself. And, well, I mean, it may have been perfect with dolphins swimming in the bay and all the perfectly manicured areas and just, the most lovely place you'd ever been. But all I could do was stand on the beach and look over at America and go, "That's my country over there. I really want to be over there." And I couldn't get there. She had pretty much deserted me at this point, but she did finally. I begged her to please just take me back to my country. So she did, begrudgingly, and got me across to the Washington state border and said, "Psh, see ya," and left me there. Well, it was getting very cold at this point, and there was definitely a chill in the air, and I didn't know what to do. I'd never hitchhiked before. Always, everything had just been miraculous. And so I was a little bit frightened now, too, not knowing where I was going to go or what I was going to do. So I called this family or friends back in Lawrence, Kansas, and they had nicely given us a shower while we were there in Lawrence, Kansas, and said, "Hey, anytime you come back through, you got a place to stay." So I phoned them up and said, "Hey, do you guys need a roommate?" I was pretty much ready to settle down for a second, and they said, "Absolutely, sure, just get here." And I'm like, all right, I'm getting there." So I went into the convenience store, and I'd already been there about 3 hours, and the lady at the register knew me already, and I had to go to the restroom, and my little dog had snuck into the store. And this couple comes walking into the store while I'm in the restroom, and they say, "Oh, what a cute doggy. Why don't we take him home?" And the lady at the register says, "Oh, no, that's the boy in the bathroom's dog. You can't take him." And they said, "Well, we'll take him home too." And I thought, and so I come out of the bathroom, and there they are, and they were like, "Do you need a home?" And I'm like, "Well, actually, I just found one. But I do need to get to it. It's in Lawrence, Kansas." And they said, "Well, that's exactly where we're going." I thought, oh, what a curious world. So they said, "Well, we've got to go drop off our load, and we'll be right back. So just hang out, and we'll be back to get you." I just knew everything was perfect again. So I went, and I sat, and I waited. And I waited, and waited, and I waited, and it started to get colder and colder, and I was watching as the truckers were crossing my path to go to the bar at the truck stop and then return, a while later, a little more drunk and a little more drunk each time. And eventually it was about 2 in the morning, and it had gotten really cold, and I had my little dog in my leather coat, and we were just sitting there waiting. And now I still had those shaman stones, the pendulum. And what you would do with them is hold them over your palm, and then you would ask a question, and it would give you a rotation in a particular, either clockwise or counterclockwise, and it would give you an answer of yes or no. And you could test it by asking it a question you knew, and it would actually spin in that direction. And then you would ask it a question you know that was no, and it would spin in the opposite direction. And so I continued to ask the stones whether these people were coming back, and they said, absolutely. These stones continued to tell me yes. So I really had faith and believed that they were returning, and I just knew in my heart that they were, that they really intended to get me home. And so eventually a trucker came up and saw me and Yin shivering in the cold, and he says, look, it's 2 in the morning, they're not coming back. Why don't you just come sit in my cab and relax and get some sleep and try again tomorrow? I reluctantly gave in. I said, all right. So I went back to the trucker's truck and sat up, climbed up in that tall cab with my little dog in my lap, and we started to settle down and get warm. And my palms were all itching because they were so cold, and here we were finally starting to get warm. And I put my head down on the dash, and the trucks continued to roll in and out of the lot there. And oh, I wanted to look. I wanted so desperately to look at each and every truck that went past just to see if it was them. But at the same time, I was so tired, and so was my little dog, and I didn't want to disturb him. But eventually, this one truck went past, and as you're going to know, it was them. But the strange thing was that I just had to look. The feeling was too strong, and I actually sat up and I watched as the truck went by, and I tried to see the number on the side of the truck, and it just pulled to such a point where the number of the truck was hidden from my view, and then pulled forward and parked. And I was like, oh my God. Now, I really didn't want to pull my poor little dog nor myself back out into that cold, but I just knew in my heart that that was them, even though the back of the truck looked totally different because they had dropped their load. So I did. I jumped out of the truck and I tried to leave little Yin inside the truck to stay warm, but he wasn't having it. So he jumped out with me and we ran over to that truck, and sure enough, it was them. Well, they weren't in it. Where did they go? I didn't know. So we started to walk around, but I didn't want to leave the truck too far, so I stayed in a kind of a radius of the truck. And eventually, there they were. They showed up and they said, oh my God, we didn't know your name, so we've been running around yelling, Yin, Yin. And they'd been looking for my dog, they figured they'd find me then. And I gave them big hugs, and I just knew they were coming, and I jumped into the truck with them, and we headed on our way. Now, the trucker that I had left, I ran back and did tell him we were leaving, just so you know. I was so amazed. I mean, goosebumps, everything, the miraculous nature of life, the flow that was carrying me forward. I had more and more faith in it all the time. So here I was in this truck, and they were caravanning with another trucker, and every now and again I would bounce into his truck for a little different conversation. But it turns out these two, this couple, were a couple of witches, and I had told them that I was very angry at that girl for doing to me what she had done, and they were like, oh no, you don't want to harbor that anger, and you don't want to send any negative thoughts because everything you send comes back to you tenfold. And I said, oh, okay. So I started to understand these laws of karma, which you'll typically get more out of a witchy type people than others. And so here I was riding for 4 days in this semi, bouncing back and forth between the two of them and going through other little miraculous events of not being seen because, well, me and the dog weren't allowed in the truck, of course, and we'd have to pull into different checkpoints, and we would just hide and, in the invisible way, and we made it through just fine. And at one point, as we were going, the blizzard finally hit. And it was a complete whiteout. And I don't know if you've driven through snow, but it is such a trip to see because it just like makes this weird view in front of you. It's very hard to describe, but it's very mesmerizing. And we were quite frightened in our truck, and we were doing about 30 miles an hour down the highway. When we finally arrived at the truck stop up ahead, We see where there are these slide marks on the parking lot where it seems that a truck had lost control and had slid, and we followed the tread marks in the snow that actually led to the friend's truck that was parked there. And we went inside, just curious as to what was going on, and these guys were just beaming. And they were so excited. They had been traveling at 100 miles an hour in this freaky snowstorm where we had been doing at most 30, usually 20. And they had been doing 100 the whole way. And they actually, it was another truck that had joined this one. And they had actually slid their trucks in sideways in tandem into the parking lot and were very excited to tell us the whole story. Well, sure enough, we just rolled on and, after 4 days in the semi and getting to know these two very well, or three counting the other truck, and they did actually pull me in and drop me off at my very doorstep in Lawrence, Kansas. And here was this semi rolling down through the neighborhood and dropped me off, and we said our goodbyes, and they rolled on down to Oklahoma where they were going. What a curious world. Well, I see that I've just about talked this hour away, and I really haven't even gotten to some more of the meat of the story, but all of this is so important to understand the true guidance that is in our lives, and that you don't need to follow this paradigm of capitalism in order to be catered or taken care of, that the universe is abundant and providing for you, and I'm trying to give you the escape mechanism. So this is the true point of my story. I was once again hoping to get to Phil Lesh, and in the day he took me to the Mason Temple, and perhaps I could spit that out right now. I don't know. I mean, we do only have about 8 minutes left. Well, it seemed I settled down in Kansas there for a while, and at this point I had gone and gotten the books back from the van and had lost a number of them to a friend that was supposed to help me that didn't, and but I got enough to start to understand. So if you realize that there I was juggling fool with the black and white spotted dog at my ankle, that I was the archetypical fool, archetypal fool, there, and now I had this whole magician's library, and the next card in the tarot card is the magician, and I'd moved on to that, and then eventually in landing in Austin and studying the goddess and moving into the next card, which is the empress. Very intriguing how my life had been following these things. So in Lawrence, Kansas, I settled down and started to study and started to learn, and this was when the Y2K celebration came along. And what a curious event that was, because now I had started to study ancient architecture at Kansas University and started to understand the harmonics and the construction that went into making the Great Pyramids and the great cathedrals. And I found it truly curious, and I'm certain that my professor was a Freemason, but I found it truly curious that he explained how the pyramids were known, that the dating of the pyramids was a known fraud, that it was actually a Freemason named Colonel Weiss who had perpetrated this fraud on the world, and that it was known and taught within the university that this dating of 3500 BC to the pharaoh Khufu or Cheops was fraudulent, that they knew this Freemason had snuck in there or actually sent his assistant in to paint the name of Khufu into the walls of this chamber, which of course it was only painted on the walls that they didn't break down, and you know, it was misspelled using Budge's mistranslated or misspelled dictionary. And so here they teach you in college that this dating of the pyramids was totally fraudulent, that they weren't dated to 3500 BC, but yet you'll still hear this continuously on the History Channel. So I find that very curious, and I also found it curious that he did note that this Colonel Weiss was a Freemason. And Through that class, I studied the cathedrals and oh, in detail. Oh my God, we had to know, how many ribbings went around the inner course of the cathedral, and I had to study and very much in detail. I had to know everything because, unlike the frat boys, I didn't know which cathedrals were going to be on the test. But of course, if you're a member of the clique, you go sign yourself away to these orders, and then you get the little help that comes along. And that's the same with the Freemasons. You go join these fraternal orders, and you get helped along the way. But you'll find that you're actually serving an evil force, whether you realize it or not. So I think I'm gonna have to leave you there. I guess I would just like to give you my final thoughts on this whole thing, and perhaps I'll get to, well, I'll definitely get to more of these stories in the future. I want to get around to, getting back to hypothesizing the world with all of you. But what has happened is that I have been given a hypothesis along the way, and so I've been trying to test it scientifically, and well, so far the hypothesis has not proven to be wrong. I used this hypothesis to determine that the buildings in, well, I didn't know what was going to happen, but I knew that there was going to be a major terrorist attack on 9/11. I used this hypothesis to determine that the next president was going to be railroaded into office, and I knew that it would be W because of his connections to Kabbalism. So I've been testing this hypothesis all along the way, which includes also this miraculous life, and so far it has been scientifically sound, and I would have to say that it is a scientific fact that the Illuminati rules our planet through magic, frequency modulation, and ritual. So until next time, be good and know that you are free.